committee will change the schedule a little bit in that Representative Nelson is present, so we will hear House Bill 2931 first. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2931. Sam?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2931 will require a public entity which receives a claim for compensation under ballot measure 37 to hold one or more public hearings on before making that decision, and also requires that any review would not go to labor but would be directed to the circuit court with a writ of review. This is the first of presumably a number of bills related to 37 that will probably be coming before the committee of session.
Thank you, Sam. Good afternoon, Representative Nelson.
Good afternoon, Chair Gerard. Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to be here today and certainly before such a distinguished committee. I am here today advocating for my constituents something that I believe very strongly in myself. So if you'll please look at the communication. I sponsored House Bill 2931 in connection with Susan and J.R. Ruggles, who are individuals in my community, in my district, and feel much like they do, in that I do believe that it's a democratic value to have public notice and public hearings on land use issues. I think that's just the most decent thing to do. So if you would please let me relate the communication from James and Susan Ruggles from McMinnville, and unfortunately a medical appointment preempted her being here today. Susan says, "We as Oregonians have held dear to the concept that our state is governed by the voice of the people and in the best interest of the citizens of this state. We did not vote for Measure 37. We did agree that our old land use laws needed some changes. We have heard numerous comments from those who voted for the measure that they did not understand the consequences. Although this measure is widely viewed as a compensation issue, especially, at the core is land use change. Previously, our system was a public process for any land use change. Therefore, first, we are strong proponents of written notification to adjoining property owners when a claim is filed. This type of notification is nothing new. Second, we are strong proponents of public hearings regarding Measure 37 claims. Applications are essentially claims for land use change, rezoning, which previously required public hearings. Yamhill County commissioners have taken a stand to hold public hearings only on applications they deem significant. That is not how government should operate in any county. And thank you for the opportunity to submit our thoughts on a few of the flaws of Measure 37. James and Susan Ruggles." And also, you have another communication from Francis and Michael O'Brien, also from my district, that reads, "With regards to Measure 37 legislation, my husband and I support public hearings, notification of neighbors, and legal hearing notices a minimum of 2 weeks, that changes, that's a good amendment, before a decision is made on Measure 37 claims." Thank you, Francis and Michael O'Brien. And to the bill, if you would please, you'll notice in House Bill 2931 that we've simply done what both of these constituent couples have asked us to do, and that's just to ask for one or more public hearing prior to making a final decision on the resolution of a claim by the authority, and also we would authorize a review of the final decision of the public entity by circuit court by writ of review, and this does prohibit review by the Land Use Board of Appeals, and it would be effective on passage declaring emergency. I do feel, we consider changes for the betterment of Measure 37. I voted for Measure 37. I was in the voter's pamphlet on behalf of Measure 37 because I had had hundreds of citizens who had felt that they had been robbed, you know, of the value of their land and what they had purchased that land for originally they no longer could do. So I became their advocate. I still am an advocate for it. I just want to be sure that it's done appropriately, democratically, and does get us to where we want to be, and that's the most efficient and effective use of our land here in Oregon. I'll take any questions.
Any questions for Representative Nelson? Representative Ackerman.
Now, Mr. Chair, I have to tell you that I served in this room with three of these individuals, and I believe Representative Ackerman sat in that same spot. Or was it one over?
No, I sat in the same spot. They don't put over on this committee.
is that permanently assigned to it? Is that his land use? What do you call it when you stake out your claim?
Well, I don't know if I've done that, but someone's done it for me.
Okay. And he has no appeal rights.
No appeal rights.
No. And we warned him beforehand not to ask you a question.
he would not miss the opportunity, I'm sure.
This means I only get two questions. If I was up on this chair, I'd get four. Okay.
And that's unlimited as you go around the table. Representative, I don't really argue with the concept of your proposal. But you require a public hearing on a claim. The claim may not proceed.
Yeah.
You can't proceed resolve a claim without holding a hearing. As I understand the draft that will come out of the Senate, and it's probably now Senate Bill 1037, I think they go through a process to determine the viability of the claim before they do public hearings. So in other words, if the claim itself is defective or invalid or not correct, there'd be no reason to have a public hearing. Would you disagree with that concept and you can revert the process here?
Chair Garrard, Representative Ackerman, I certainly do.
Okay.
Let's don't waste the public taxpayers' money if we don't have to. That's exactly what is happening in my county. That planning division is evaluating the claim to see if it did have a different designation at one time and before it, you know, it's even brought up for a hearing to the commissioners.
Thank you.
And the truth is our commissioners are doing a great job. We've only had two that they felt were huge claims that they ought to have public notice and public hearing, and but now seem to continue to offer the opportunity of public hearings.
That's all I have.
Oh, is this wonderful?
No, I'm one question. Hold one reserve.
Any further questions?
So, Representative Melvin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to follow up a little bit on that line of reasoning, Representative. Do you have a minimum threshold for when you think a public body like a county commission or a city council should hold a public hearing before spending money to a claim for compensation?
No, I
should there be a minimum amount?
That's a that's a very good question. I've not thought of it in that light. We'll research it. I don't know that answer.
Quick follow-up just to clarify. What I'm trying to get at is whether you see a difference between a claim for, say, $500 or a claim for $50,000 or $250,000. Whether you would advocate for a public hearing in either case, regardless of the amount.
Representative Garrard, Chair Garrard, Representative Miller, I understood that is what you asked the first time, and I haven't looked at it in that light. I can see where, you know, a $20,000 you know, piece of land might have less impact than one that's, you know, $2 million. Which we happen to have in my county at this time. But I'm not sure that, you know, a public notice and public hearing would be that costly on any of them, frankly. I think it's a very democratic thing to do. Knowledge is power, and I think we all know the full situation. We don't live in everybody's neighborhood, so there's a lot to learn from each other.
One more quick follow-up. I'm not quarreling with the notion of notice. What I'm asking about is the need to notice, for example, 2 weeks in advance of the public hearing and publish publishing in papers, whether you think that's a good idea anytime a public body wants to spend $500 or $2,000 or $2 million.
Chair Gerard, Representative Nolan, I think it's an excellent thing to do, and I think our newspapers ought to do that just out of public service, and I hope they're listening. Because we do not have a daily newspaper anywhere in our county. We have four newspapers, a weekly, a monthly, a three times a week, and a twice a week. And you wouldn't hurt them. I mean, 2 weeks in advance, I think is good. Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, I don't see wording that would indicate a hearing in the initiative itself. Do you think your constituents were considering this, that this might be kind of a mandate in terms of cost to the cities, the counties, or would it increase their costs without any money from the state or the initiative or any other body?
Chair Gerard, Anderson, of course, here's what I questioned originally was, since we're not allowed to send down a mandate on the county anymore, if this could even pass muster, frankly. However, what I heard was that this great committee is considering an omnibus bill, and maybe through that process we can, get some mutual... mutual agreement, but majority on how we should handle these. I just think it's a great thing to do.
Thank you.
Any further questions of Representative Nelson? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Chair Gerard, and I would like to wish your committee administrator a happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you.
Great.
Would you like me to sing for you?
Oh, no, that's okay.
Well, I did sing for Senator Shields the other day in committee.
I think a duet with the director of the department would be a good idea.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Sam. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
Thank you.
It's the first time we've convened a singing community in Landry.
Well, maybe that's what it should be, a singing public hearing.
Yes, thank you, Representative. Lane Shetterly. Same time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lane Shetterly, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I was wondering if I was going to make it on a Sunday night tape this session. No, I think I might, at least from the back of the room. Happy birthday, Sam. Mr. Chair, I understand this is a preliminary conversation about the issue of hearings, and so my testimony will be general, not for at least the reason that I brought the wrong file when I came today, but with regard to public hearings on ballot measure 37 claims, I just want to raise a couple of issues for the committee's consideration as we begin to look at this. First of all, as you may know, the state process as it is currently constructed does not provide for a public hearing. That reflects the advice of the Department of Justice that the measure does not require public hearings. What the state rule requires is notice to adjoining property owners with an opportunity to comment in writing. And then the response to any of those comments that may be pertinent in the order that would come out from the state agency. Looking at hearings a couple of weeks ago, at least the issue of hearings, the Land Conservation and Development Commission determined that at least as the commission is currently constructed and the department is staffed and resourced, we don't have the capacity to conduct hearings on all of the claims that will be coming before us. And there are several logistical issues, not the least of which is just the sheer volume. There are well over 200 claims now and climbing on a literally daily basis. And looking at least at LCDC, that of course is a voluntary citizen board with folks who live in Union County and Medford and over on the coast, and be very difficult to convene them on a regular basis to accommodate that kind of volume of claims, particularly recognizing the 180-day timeline. We have to move these claims through to final decision. And then at least at the state level, the consideration of where would the claims, where would the hearings be held? If I was a Rowala County property owner, I probably wouldn't feel too warm about having to go to Salem to have my claim heard, and I'm sure the property owners neighboring to that claim probably would feel the same way. By the same token, if we were to make those field hearings, that just raises again the logistical issues of how you get all those hearings heard in the number of counties in which claims are pending. You could, I suppose, with the legislation, appoint a cadre of hearings officers who might be tasked to go and conduct the hearings around the state, but that would be a staff that we don't have at this point, and we're really not talking about just LCDC, but any other state agencies that will be handling these claims as well. So as an advocate and champion of Goal 1, which is a citizen involvement in the land use process, it's difficult to look at this issue and say that we just don't know how, within reasonable staffing and resource levels, we could accommodate hearings on all of the claims. It will be very difficult to do at the state level. And so I just raise those concerns as the committee carries this forward for discussion. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions of Mr. Shadowbridge? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Scott.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Art Sock. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. And let me, I think, second most of the comments that Mr. Shutterly just made. As you know, counties, either by ordinances or resolutions or different means, have adopted a process and procedures for handling Measure 37 claims. And counties have varied in their approach to how they handle the claims, from an administrative process to a process that requires a notice and an opportunity to comment. And some local jurisdictions have looked at public hearings in conjunction with the processing the application. I think, and I guess I would also point out that in the land use planning program and the permitting that we do, there are a lot of land use permits that are processed with notice and an opportunity to comment, but not public hearings, as we have strive to have land use decisions done in a more timely manner, and to, you know, keep the costs down, to be efficient at this point. There has been the right to appeal that might get you to a public hearing, but at least the initial decision is made without public hearing. That being said, Mr. Chair, we think that that this issue is part of the larger Measure 37 issue that the legislature is dealing with, and it should be, if it's looked at as part of an omnibus bill dealing with how we're going to process claims within the state, not only at the state level but as also at the city and county level. I think there is value in notice and an opportunity to comment. And I think that whether a local jurisdiction has a public hearing should be subject to the local decision-making process and not in statute. There are, I guess, good reasons why a county will choose to conduct public hearings, and there are good reasons why they will choose to do it with an opportunity for notice and an opportunity to comment. Certainly costs are a matter, and I think that, you know, as we look at an omnibus bill, there may be a ceiling placed on, you know, the amount of fees that can be required. That might be one thing, but certainly, you know, all of these things do add up to costs, And I think that, again, I'll just reiterate, I think that the question of holding public hearings should be a local decision, and that distinction should be left to them. So, Mr. Chair, if I can answer any questions, I'd be happy to.
Any questions for Mr. Stein? Seeing none, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Anyone else wish to testify in regards to House Bill 2931? Seeing none, committee, this bill, as well as other bills dealing with Measure 37 that we've been given public hearing, are being held in committee for review in anticipation of a House Omnibus 37 bill. So kind of parallels what Mr. Schleif was saying. Okay, committee, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2931 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3312.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 3312 is a bill which would allow a governing body, city or county, to be able to contract with other entities for any studies that may be required as part of a development permit associated with the review of the approval for that land use decision for that particular piece of property. Many times smaller cities and counties can have very limited resources and staff personnel to be able to allow them to thoroughly review a proposal. This particular language would explicitly allow the jurisdiction to then be able to contract for any additional help. So it could be things about groundwater studies or transportation analysis studies, things that just cannot be done in-house, and would give them the authority to go out to contract.
Do you have any discussion of House Bill 3312? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3312 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3286.
House Bill 3286 is one which would seek to adopt what's referred to as the Uniform Environmental Covenants Act, and that is an act which would allow the owners of property to enter into environmental covenants. And specifically, we're talking about property where there's been some kind of contamination on that site. These are oftentimes referred to as brownfields, quote-unquote, properties that remain fallow for some number of years due to the issues associated with the contamination. They can involve going into long-term environmental remediation for the cleanup. There are also that can be very time consuming. It can take years. There can be a lot of liability costs in trying to determine who is responsible and the payment thereof. And there also becomes a real question regarding the sale of the property to new owners, because they're often very hesitant to become associated with property because of the liability issues involved. This particular measure that you have before you has been introduced in a number of states, and it seeks to allow a process to be developed where property can be then transferred to a new owner, and there would be covenants, environmental covenants, that would restrict the use. It would be very clear about these covenants would not remove any responsibility associated with the cleanup from any parties. What it would do is it would allow the property, the new owners, to be able to then come in and be able to do some use of the property, which would then allow something to happen viably in a business sense to that property without there being the liability associated with the new owners. This particular bill has been requested by the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, where they wish to be able to provide clear statutory language in all states' codes regarding this, because currently my understanding is that there's a real hodgepodge throughout the different states on how to deal with that, and most of this other state requirements are kind of left vague on what is and what is not the relevant statutory authority here. And I think that Joe Willis is here to be able to explain this a little bit more in depth. Mr. Willis?
Chair Gerard and members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to be here. I'm here as a Oregon Uniform Law Commissioner to the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Law. And let me, your committee administrator probably did a better job than I could possibly do explaining the broad purpose of this bill. But I would like to reiterate two things. One, it seeks not to displace any of the regulatory powers of any of the regulators on cleanup. It's an overlay system that takes away what in many states have come to be problems with the common law, trying to create a perpetual interest in land that can be enforced not only by the regulators but others that have an interest in enforcing it. So when you have circumstances that a particular problem in the dirt would not be appropriate to have, for instance, a school sited on it or homes or children playing about, but might work very well for some other industrial use, if it was limited to that use and properly contained, that you can have these types of institutional controls in place. The common law, although it's flexible and it has made some move in this area, has some problems in trying to create that legal interest to make that work best. Ergo, that's why the National Conference got in this area. And let me tell you a little bit about what it went through to come to this point with you. It's a voluntary association of states whose main purpose is to try to figure out where we can have uniformity of laws where it's appropriate amongst the states, short of leaving everything to the federal government to be done by the feds. And this was one of the areas because of the state common law rules, even though it has a heavy overlay with federal regulation as well as state regulation that we worked in. The drafting committee that did this, and I was not amongst them, I'm not an expert in this area, it's not my practice area, but I served on the National Conference since 1978. I went through the floor debates that occurred at least two full times on this, and the drafting committees had a very wide constituency. They had people there from the banking industry, finance industry, they had people there from the regulatory community, they had people there from the technical community, from the petroleum industry, and they had tremendous expertise and advice in putting this together. And they tried to do the best they could to vet it throughout all those constituencies as they were going through the process. Then, when it was all done, they went through the drafting committee came up with the language they came up with as in the Uniform Act. They then presented it to the full conference, which is probably at any one time you'd have 350 lawyers sitting out there, and the act is really read line by line, and it's debated fully to get a better drafting product. Then it went to the American Bar Association, and of course the American Bar Association has various groups and sections that have a really interest in these things. It was adopted by the American Bar Association's House of Governors, and then went out to the states with a recommendation to all the states to please consider and pass this as a uniform act. My concern here is now twofold. We spoke to DEQ representatives last week. They raised an issue. I think their unofficial position was neutrality. I hope that hasn't changed, but just because of timing. But they raised two points I think are very good. One of them was their concern that it hasn't been vetted sufficiently in Oregon with the Oregon constituencies that would have an interest. Knowing how much the National Conference went at vetting it and the broad base we tried to include through that process, I think I'm a little less sympathetic to that, but not entirely unsympathetic because it is important. And from the National Conference point of view, we're happy to try to accomplish that. I'm worried about timing because of your legislative committees and the demands on the legislature and when you have to end. The other point was, they pointed out, technically, through the process of legislative council drafting this, there are some omissions that I can't account for, but they are technically significant and that needs attention. Now, I could accomplish those changes and get back to the committee within a week, but I could not get, you know, any kind of a broad-based invitation to come and sit and listen to a presentation about the bill. I've talked to the National Conference representatives, to the chairman of the drafting committee, and our law professor, reporter, who is on the East Coast, but who is expert in this area. They would like to, if we do further vetting in Oregon to the various constituencies, which would be the regulators, the consultants, the lawyers, the finance people, they would like to have at their arms some of the more technical people they had during the drafting process. We think we could get that accomplished within 30 days. but that's very ambitious because we've got, if we do it, we want to have those same technical people that worked on this for 3 years to be able to answer those questions and explain it to the various constituencies. So I'm here actually urging you to look favorably on this bill with those conditions. Let me get back to you with further amendments to take care of the technical problems, and honestly just seek your advice on what we should do about trying to move it forward this session, try to accomplish that that vetting of it in the next 30 days, or will we have to wait? And I very much appreciate your consideration.
Any questions or comments to Mr. Willis? He'd like to be in agreement.
I wonder, as I read this, I was trying to figure out, I live on the edge of Forest Park, and some people have been talking about putting environmental easements on my property on a voluntary basis, which would provide some permanent protection for wildlife corridors and things like that. Is that sort of thing a part of this bill as well? I was trying to read it to see.
Representative Chair Barrard and Representative Greenlee, short answer is no, but it's akin to that. I mean, what you're describing is probably some type of conservation easement, something that would last. You can make it in perpetuity. You would have rights of those persons who then, if it was created, could enforce it. And that has become quite common in this country to do. You can even do it in a fashion to reap some reasonable tax advantages from doing so for some people that occasion to do that. But the only parallel is that the creation of the legal right that you're talking about that will last, be defined, and have enforceability in it. But you're talking in one sense, I think, about trying to find out what the conservation means, but another you're trying to talk about putting these controls on so that everyone has concluded that it's safe to use that property for whatever use is described in the manner that it's described and limited as described in perpetuity, so that when these standards sometimes cannot be met, either technically or for financial reasons, you can get that back in the stream of commerce and you can make use of the property that everybody agrees is appropriate, safe use.
Any other questions? Just one, Mr. Wolf. Could somebody buy a piece of property that, say, it's been in a brownfield type situation at any stage under this, develop an environmental covenant and then sell that land?
I'll answer that with one hedge, as I'm not the expert on this, but as it stands today, if you posit someone wanting to buy a piece of property that they know is contaminated, unless they have very, very good consultants and idea of what the cleanup costs are going to be, they just won't do it, because under the laws, the liability for that cleanup transfers to the owner unless they can come up with a defense of good faith ignorance, which is almost impossible to do. So without this, that probably wouldn't happen. With this, once the covenant is in place, then that transfer could be made, but the transferee would be limited to using the property pursuant to the covenant. And if they thought maybe they got a very good deal and wanted to hedge or push a little bit, that covenant could be enforced both by the regulators and other interested parties to make sure that they did what they said they were going to do when they acquired the property.
So I'm just going to follow up. Let's say that somebody just put a distressed price on a piece of what could be valuable property if it were environmentally clean. So with the environmental covenant, that could be achieved as long as the buyer was aware and agreed to the covenant.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, I lost you on that. No,
okay. Let's say there's a prime piece of real estate.
Yes.
But it's contaminated.
Yes.
The owner of the property puts it on the market at a distressed price. Under this, there would be nothing stopping the owner and the seller agreeing to a covenant and then selling the property.
I have to double check the language, but I think you also have to have the regulatory community involved in approving that covenant, because this doesn't supply.
I'm assuming that, yeah. Yes. With the adoption of the covenant and the fact that DEQ would be a part of that covenant, that would all be agreed upon. As long as the buyer agreed to do whatever it took to clean up that property, that nothing would stop that sale.
That's true, but I would envision it not, but the property not being cleaned up further, but the restriction of the use of the property and the covenant would be the safety factor that would be used to make sure it wasn't used for inappropriate purpose. But okay. In essence, I think the concept is correct.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Wells.
I don't know how to best communicate with Woody on the timing on that. We'll try to move forward. And
are you going to be around for a couple of minutes?
Yes, I am.
We have a little bit more testimony, then I may bring you back, and we'll try and set a date for you.
Thank you.
Okay. Bob Danko and Johnny Lamon. The dreaded Department of Environmental Quality.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bob Danko with the Department of Environmental Quality. With me is Charlie Lamon. He has probably the most experience with covenants in the department, so he'll be good, hopefully, to answer a lot of the questions. Thank you for allowing me to testify. I think it's my first appearance in front of the Land Use Committee. I'll probably be back on another bill.
Well, we're very lucky. We also have the chair of the Environment Committee sitting to my left, so...
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I've gotten to know him this session pretty well. We are neutral on this bill, Mr. Chair, in committee. The bill doesn't have a fiscal for us at DEQ. We appreciate Mr. Willis bringing his spirit on behalf of the National Commission. This is an important area for us at the department. We generally already do what the bill would allow us to do, and we've been doing it, we think, quite successfully since mostly 1995, when the legislature rewrote the cleanup law, and we went to what we call risk-based cleanups. And what that means is sometimes contamination is left in place, but there's controls, institutional controls put on the property to ensure that property does not become a risk down the road. And that's how we've been using these covenants. For instance, like a soil cap, for instance, or some sort of limitation on using groundwater, examples like that. We think there's probably about 100 of these in that range that we've done since 1995. When this national uniform model came out a year and a half ago, we looked at it internally at the department. We decided not to bring it forward as a legislative concept this time, not because we think it may help us a little bit, but since essentially we're already doing what the bill allows, it didn't rise up to the level that we need to bite it off as a department to bring a legislative concept forward. We don't bring very many legislative concepts to this legislature. And as Mr. Willis said, if this committee wants to move forward this bill, we have some technical issues with the bill. It varies some from the national model that was produced. It might have been drafting in large council, but there are some differences there that we'd want to resolve. And also, we want to address how it really blends into the work we're doing now. I think our bigger concern is more of a process issue. We are very careful at the department to work with all our stakeholders, and when we come to the legislature with a change in one of the laws that affects us, we like to make sure everybody is on board with it, everybody knows about it, everybody's had a chance to ask their questions. And in this case, that hasn't happened, and we feel an obligation to all our stakeholders to make sure they are comfortable with something like this, that they have played a part in that they shaped the 1995 cleanup law with us, and they've been a part of implementing it since then. And so we feel an obligation to that broader stakeholder community, attorneys, consultants, property owners, industrial landowners, and so on, that this would impact. And we haven't really, we'd have to begin that discussion now. We haven't had a chance to do that in the last week since we talked to Mr. Willis. An alternative we have to offer is that after the session's over during the next interim, we are going to convene a committee, a work group, to look at several parts of our existing cleanup law and how we're implementing it. We'd like to do that to make sure we're in touch and on board with what our stakeholders want and make sure we have the best program going, and we're going to do that anyways, and this could fit into that review, and we could take a look at it and include all the stakeholders. So the bottom line is that if the committee wants to move forward now, we'll work with Mr. Willis quickly and try to gear up all the stakeholders and other interested parties to make sure that we bring something back that is, Mr. Willis brings something back that is the best thing for Oregon, or we can address it during the interim.
Bob, you're always welcome in front of this committee, too, by the way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, then we'll have that question.
I don't think Mr. Lehman is
Mr. Chair, I do have one thing. I noticed that you celebrated a birthday here today. It turns out that most of you probably know Mr. Dankel maybe better than I do. It's Bob's birthday today as well. I knew this committee would want to take the opportunity.
Please don't.
Take over there, Bob.
Thank you.
But since Representative Nelson has left, you've escaped the singing committee twice in one day. So, Bob, I'm wondering if could I have Mr. Willis come back up for a moment? If Mr. Willis, if you would agree perhaps to have your bill amended that we assist the Department of Environmental Quality in establishing this interim task force to look at this issue and that you're involved in that, would that be agreeable to all of the parties?
From the National Conference point of view, Chair Gerard, members of the committee, it's not disagreeable. Our preference would be to try to move forward on it because we have a biennial session. And I am a little bit concerned because this has been one of the bills targeted by the National Conference to present all 50 states. They're very active in doing that. I would, worry a little bit that somehow some of our neighboring states would adopt it around us, and we didn't, and it has more flexibility to try and create these properties that can be used and transferred. That's the only problem. But other than that, we must abide by the wish of the chair and the committee. I'm happy to do it.
So. Mr. Junko, how long would it take you to contact some of the interested parties and inform them of this possible legislation? Could you do it in 30 days?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, we could do that. It would be a pretty significant endeavor for us, but yes, we could do it.
Yeah, would that sound agreeable to you, Mr. Willis?
Certainly.
If we gave you, say, till May 2nd?
Certainly.
And then have both of you come back on May 2nd and see if it's possible that we can put some legislation together.
And I, with permission of the chair, I'll go forward too and immediately take care of those technical corrections so that we get those out of the way. I think that's the easier part.
Excellent. So. Then we'll reschedule for these two parties in particular to come back on May 2nd and see if we can put something together. Thank you.
Okay.
We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4286. And committee, we have revised the schedule for the week, and you have Friday off. So I just wanted to let you know. And also, the draft that you received on Friday is now beneficially dropped and is Senate Bill 1037. Correct? 1037. Have a good day, committee, and we are adjourned.